Hello, folks. It's good to be with you again. On our last program, we mentioned that money is either spent into circulation or loaned into circulation. And we also said that 97% of our money has been loaned into circulation. We also said that our monetary system is based on fractional reserve banking. Today, we are going to discuss fractional reserve banking in more detail. But first, let me give you two very good sites to visit on your computer for more information. First is the American Monetary Institute, or AMI for short. The second is Modern Money Mechanics. Let me repeat those two sites again. First is the American Monetary Institute, and the second is Modern Money Mechanics. You can pull both of them up on your computer. This would also be a good time to have pencil and paper handy for use for some figures I give, and also to make notes in order to ask me questions later. Now, let's talk about fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking had its origins with the goldsmiths of the Middle Ages. At that time, the goldsmiths had strong warehouses where their gold was kept. Oftentimes, a citizen would acquire a gold coin, and since he didn't want to get hit in the head and have his gold coin stolen, he would take it to the goldsmith and ask the goldsmith if he, the goldsmith, would keep the gold coin for him, the citizen. The goldsmith might say, "Well, sure, but I'm going to charge you rent for this service." The citizen would agree, and the goldsmith would give him a receipt showing that he, the goldsmith, had the individual's gold coin. Today, this receipt would be called a certificate of deposit or simply a CD. If the citizen went out into the village or town and discovered a pair of boots he wanted, he would have to go back to the goldsmith and withdraw his gold coin. The citizen would then exchange the gold coin for the boots. What would the bootmaker then do with the gold coin? He'd take it back to the goldsmith for safekeeping, too. He didn't want to get hit in the head, either. Even when the gold coin was used for business transactions, it usually wound up back in the goldsmith's warehouse every night. Transacting business in this manner soon became very cumbersome, so the practice evolved, whereby the citizen would show the bootmaker his receipts, which showed that he had the gold coin in the goldsmith's warehouse, and he would sign over the receipt to the bootmaker. Soon receipts began passing from buyer to seller instead of the gold coin going from hand to hand. The gold coin stayed in the warehouse gathering dust. Life in the Middle Ages wasn't much different from life in our era. People often needed to borrow money for various reasons. The borrower might go to the goldsmith and ask him if he had any money to loan. The goldsmith might say, "Well, sure, I got this dusty old gold coin no one is using. I'll loan it to you, but I'll charge you a small amount of usury, or interest as we call it today." If the citizen agreed, then he, the citizen, would leave with the gold coin. Let's go over this scenario again. A stranger comes to town with a gold coin. There is one unit of purchasing power in the town, isn't there? He deposits the gold coin with the goldsmith and receives a deposit ticket for it. There is still only one unit of purchasing power, isn't there? The purchasing power is not the gold coin, but the receipt for the gold coin. The goldsmith then loans the gold coin to another person. How many units of purchasing power are in the community now? Two, the original gold coin and the receipt for the gold coin. What happened to the stranger's purchasing power? Well, theoretically, it was cut in half, wasn't it? How was this done? Through a process we call inflation. Who started the inflation? The banker. How did he start it? By making loans using someone else's deposits. As you will soon see, it gets even better with time. Soon, when the borrower would come to the goldsmith for a loan, the goldsmith would say, "You don't want one of these heavy, dusty gold coins. Someone might hit you in the head and steal it. I'll just give you a receipt showing that you have a gold coin in my warehouse or bank. You can give this to any merchant, and he will accept it as payment because he knows that he can bring this receipt to me, and I will give him a gold coin." This paper receipt, or CD, then became known as a banknote, and this is how the goldsmith turned in to the banker. It wasn't long before the banker learned that he could loan out more notes than he had coins in the warehouse, but he had to keep some coins on hand because some of the people would occasionally show up and turn in or redeem the notes for the metallic coins. The coins on hand were just a fraction of the amount of notes the goldsmith would issue, but he needed to keep the coins as a reserve to redeem the notes. This is how fractional reserve banking was born. Once again, I reiterate, remember the term, fractional reserve banking. Let's see what the Federal Reserve Bank has to say about the subject of goldsmiths, banks, loans, and money creation. Remember, the Federal Reserve is the monetary authority of this country. The following comes from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago in one of their publications called Modern Money Mechanics, which you can get online. On page 3 of this book, it says, "Banks can build up deposits by increasing loans." Did you know that? I had a hard time understanding that statement. I know I'm just a cute kid from Farmersburg, Indiana. I know I'm not too sophisticated, not well educated, not even very smart. But I know what a deposit is. We used to pile them up behind the barn back where I come from, and whenever someone came over to borrow some of that deposit to fertilize their garden, the deposit didn't increase, it went down. But it says here that bank deposits can build up by increasing loans. How? Well, they tell us in the same paragraph. It says, "This unique attribute of the banking business was discovered many centuries ago. As early bankers, they initially provided safekeeping services, making a profit from vault storage fees for gold and coins deposited with them. People would redeem their deposit receipts whenever they needed gold or coins to purchase something and physically take the gold or coins to the seller, who in turn would deposit them for safekeeping, often with the same banker. Everyone soon found that it was a lot easier simply to use the deposit receipts directly as a means of payment. These receipts, which became known as notes, were acceptable as money since whoever held them could go to the banker and exchange them for metallic money. The bankers discovered that they could make loans merely by giving their promises to pay banknotes to borrowers." Now, folks, how would you like to fly into Chicago and go over and rent a car? You fill out the papers, pay the clerk, and the clerk gives you the keys and tells you that the car is in the parking lot beside the building. You go outside and discover there are no cars in the lot, so you come back and you say, "Hey, there are no cars in that lot." And the clerk says, "I know that." And then you say, "But you promised to rent me a car." And the clerk answers, "That's right. We charged you for promising to rent you a car." And you ask, "Why?" The clerk tells you, "You see, we found it a lot more profitable that way." Boy, you can't argue with logic like that. But I'll tell you this, if a promise to pay money is money, then a promise to rent a car is a car, and a promise to sell a hat is a hat. Most historians, when looking at banking history, consider the Bank of England to be the first prototype of our modern banks. The Bank of England was established by Sir John Hublin and William Patterson in 1694. These two men promoted $72,000 in gold to be used as bank reserves and loaned King William III $1,200,000 in paper receipts at 8% interest so he, King William, could fight his war with France, and the Bank of England still owned the gold. When William Patterson was promoting the gold for the bank's reserve, he said, "The bank hath benefit of all the interest which it gets from nothing." Oh, I know some of you are saying, "No, Great Britain denominated their money in pounds, not dollars." I know, but for most of us, the term dollar is easier to understand. Now, back to the subject. Does this really give you a better idea of why Jesus ran the bankers out of the temple with a whip? You know, Jesus got along fine on this earth for the first 2 years of his teaching. Yes, he was questioned, but nothing seriously happened to him until he and the bankers disagreed with each other and he ran them out of the temple. But the day after that, he was questioned. The next day, he was denied. The next day, he was tried. And the next day, he was crucified. Now, for me, when I picture gold used as reserves and notes used as money, I imagine the gold as yeast for baking bread. I like to think of the receipts as money or also the finished product we call bread. You can't bake bread without yeast, unless it's unleavened bread, which we won't go into. Now, back to money. As the principal on these loans that were made with paper receipts were repaid with paper receipts, the goldsmith would tear up the receipts, thus destroying the money he had created. If he hadn't, he would have been covered up with paper receipts. And the same is true today. When the principal on a loan is repaid at any bank, the money is destroyed. A good way to visualize this is to think of a loan, or new money created, as accounts receivable to the bank, which it is. As the loan is repaid, the outstanding balance on the accounts receivable, or money, diminishes. Back in the old days, many goldsmiths demanded that the usury or interest be paid in gold. Now, the goldsmith did not let the populace know how he made a living, and most people today still don't know how fractional reserve banking works. The goldsmith had to keep the correct ratio of gold coin on hand to the notes outstanding. It was sometimes a life and death struggle. If the goldsmith did not have enough coins on hand to exchange for the notes when the populace redeemed them, or the citizen discovered the goldsmith was creating more receipts than he had gold in the warehouse, the goldsmith could find that his neck would grow in length with the help of a rope and tree. If, for example, the goldsmith or banker decided that he could make loans of 10 paper receipts for every one gold coin he had in his vault or warehouse, and found out that the ratio of 10 paper receipts to one gold coin would be a good safe ratio, he might feel secure. In this discussion, I'll always use the ratio of 10 to 1. I may state it as 10%. But just to let you know, in the real world, the ratio could be different. Now back to the goldsmith. If, for example, the goldsmith had 2 gold coins on hand and he used the ratio of 10 to 1 for making loans, he could create 20 paper receipts representing 20 gold coins, which of course the goldsmith didn't have. But if a citizen were to redeem one gold coin with one paper receipt, the goldsmith would have 19 outstanding notes and only one gold coin in reserve. So the ratio would be 19 paper receipts to one gold coin instead of 10 paper receipts to one gold coin, and this could be a dangerous ratio for the goldsmith. The goldsmith needed to receive 9 more paper receipts so he could destroy them and keep the relation of 10 receipts to 1 gold coin. One way to rectify the problem would be to deny loans until enough loans were repaid to bring the ratio of 10 to 1 back in balance. Or he could call in 9 outstanding loans. Either way, 9 more receipts had to be destroyed until there were only 10 notes outstanding for 1 gold coin in the goldsmith's safe. What happened when the loans were denied or outstanding loans were called in? Employers couldn't borrow money to pay their laborers. Laborers couldn't buy meat at the butcher's. Butchers couldn't purchase cows and pigs from the farmer, etc., etc. Happens. This causes unemployment, industrial bankruptcy. It demolishes property values. It drains national treasuries, and it enriches the speculators. Today we might call this tight money, or it is another example of trickle-down economics. It's also called a recession or a depression. Now, if he had the nerve, the goldsmith could change the ratio from 10 to 1 to 15 to 1, issuing 15 notes for every 1 gold coin he had. Another way for the goldsmith to keep the ratio in good balance would be for one goldsmith to borrow a gold coin from another goldsmith for a short while until the borrowing goldsmith's ratio of 10 to 1 could be corrected. Goldsmiths found that cooperation between themselves was very profitable. Because gold is a commodity and cannot be created with the stroke of a pen or the whir of a computer disk, bankers were limited to the amount of bread or money they could bake using gold as the basis. The more gold coins or yeast that the goldsmith had in stock, the more interest he could make on paper receipts. So he started offering a small amount of interest on gold coins, deposited to his warehouse or bank, and the goldsmith could then use them to make 10 times more paper receipts, generating interest to him. It's easy to see that inflation and recession are dangerous. The ratio of money in circulation must be kept in the current proportion for economic and population growth in order for a society to function smoothly. Remember how the goldsmith had to keep a certain amount of metallic money on hand to redeem his customer's note, and this metallic money was known as a reserve? Today, banks are required to keep a certain amount of reserves on hand. This amount is dictated to them by the Federal Reserve Bank in their district. I live in the state of Florida. Our commercial banks are following the rules laid down to them by the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta, Georgia. Modern reserves is the percentage of deposits which a bank cannot lend or use to invest in anything. The percentage of reserves the banks must hold has been as high as 22%, which it was during the Great Depression, and as low as 3%, which it is today, on the first $25 million of deposits a bank has, and will increase gradually as the total volume of transaction deposits expand. At the present time, most banks cannot use less than 10% of their reserve requirement, except as previously stated. This does not mean that they have to go that low. It means that they cannot go any lower. To figure the total expansion a bank may obtain, you divide the bank's total deposit by the percentage of the reserve requirement. The smaller the reserve requirement, the larger the expansion. As you can see, if the deposit is $1,000 and the reserve requirement is 10%, you divide the $1,000 deposit by 10% and get the expansion of $10,000. If the reserve requirement is 15%, the expansion is $6,666.67. If the reserve requirement is 20%, the expansion is only $5,000. A banker might argue about this with you and say, no, a 10% reserve requirement on a $1,000 deposit means that the bank must keep 10% of the money in its reserves and can only loan out $900. But he might not tell you that when the $900 is deposited into a bank, any bank, the original bank where the $900 was loaned or an out-of-state bank, the banker can lend 90% of the $900 deposit to another borrower or a total of $810. And that money, when deposited in a bank, can allow that bank to loan out 90% of $810 or $729 to the next borrower. Each new deposit allows 90% of that deposit to be loaned to the next borrower until the total of $9,000 is made into new money. When you deposit a $1,000 check in your bank, the bank has $1,000 more in deposits and $1,000 more in reserves. Since the bank is required to keep 10% of that deposit as reserves, the bank has $900 in excess reserves, which the bank can make loans with. That's what the bank will call the $900. It's called excess reserves. And excess reserves, staying in the bank, generate no interest to the bank and has no income from excess reserves. Supposing that the demand loan at your bank is slack, the bank would then probably purchase securities. If the sellers of the securities were customers, your bank would make payment by crediting the customer's checking account. Deposit liabilities would rise just as if loans had been made. More likely, these banks would purchase the securities through a dealer's paying for them with checks on themselves or on their reserve accounts. These checks would be deposited in the seller's bank. In either case, the net effects on the banking system are identical with those resulting from loan operations. Now, if you meet the high standards set down by the banking institutions, you may qualify for a loan, and if they grant you a loan, you will be required to pay the loan plus interest. Interest on what? Interest on a loan that was never made with money the bank never had. If you have bad credit, you may not be granted the loan. So your credit has to be good before you are granted credit in which to pay interest on. Since you must have good credit, just whose credit are you paying interest on? You're paying interest on your own good credit, but the bank tells you they are granting you credit. Have any of you ever been in a shabby bank? For the next part of our discussion, it would be helpful to you to get a blank piece of paper and pretend it is a clock. At 12 o'clock, make a square and label it John Q. Citizen. At 3 o'clock, make a square and label it First State Bank. At 6 o'clock, make a square and label it Federal Reserve. And at 9 o'clock, make a square and label it U.S. Treasury. As you look at your paper, I suggest that you follow the money by drawing lines as I mention the money circulating from one entity to the next. It may help your understanding of the subject a little better. And this money will travel from the Federal Reserve to the Treasury, from the Treasury to John Q. Citizen, from John Q. Citizen to the First State Bank, and from the First State Bank back to the Fed. Now, I'll also suggest you keep this paper and refer to it on our next program. We will use it again. you will learn that John Kenneth Galbraith was right when he said, "The process by which banks create money is so simple that the mind is repelled." I guess most of you know that the Federal Reserve was originally referred to as the Federal Reserve Bank, and now it is often referred to as just the Fed. It is a bank, and we'll discuss it in greater detail on a future program. And I am also sure that you know much of the time the Treasury of the United States has not collected enough in taxes to pay its bills, so it must borrow money to make the payment. Our Treasury uses government bonds as collateral to acquire loans for this purpose. Now, if you were to loan the money to the U.S. Treasury, there would not be any change in the money supply. The balance in your checking account would dwindle, and the U.S. Treasury's checking account would increase. The amount of money in the money supply would not change. Let's assume the government needs to borrow money this month to make its Social Security payments. So the U.S. Treasury goes, hat in hand, to the Federal Reserve with government bonds and asks for a loan. The Federal Reserve credits the U.S. Treasury with $1 billion and keeps the U.S. bonds. Here you see, we're going to draw a line from the Fed to the U.S. Treasury. That's where the money goes, from the Fed to the Treasury. Now the debt to the United States has increased by $1 billion, but we also have another $1 billion to spend. A little footnote here. Usually the Fed does not buy government bonds directly from the Treasury. They sometimes do when they need to replace the securities that have come due or that they have sold. Actually, the transaction is handled through a bond dealer, and I'll try to explain it later in fuller detail on another program. Now we are just trying to keep it simple for a better overall understanding. So here's my question. Where did the Federal Reserve get the $1 billion it used to buy the bonds from the U.S. Treasury on September 30th, 1941, before the House Banking and Currency Committee? Congressman Wright Patman, who was at that time chairman of the committee, asked Mariner Eccles, who at that time was the governor of the Federal Reserve. He held the same position that Janet Yellen holds today. And Wright Patman asked Mariner Eccles this question, quote, "Where did you get the money to purchase those government bonds?" And Mr. Eccles replied. That brings to a close our program for today. If you want to hear Mariner Eccles' reply, you're going to have to tune in to our next program. This is the Old Scotchman telling you that I'm really glad that you were listening to me. I hope you've learned something. We will be going into the Federal Reserve more on our next program. But before we do that, we're going to continue our program with money creation and money destruction as it applies to the Federal Reserve and its many commercial bank branches. And that's what we'll be covering on our next program, and we'll probably get into the idea of us starting our own country, say somewhere around Antarctica. You'll also need a pencil and paper for that program. And also the program after that, it would be very helpful if you had a $10 bill Federal Reserve note. We're going to be talking about the Federal Reserve notes, and that's going to take possibly 10 to 15 minutes. And it would be nice if you had one to look at, but it's not absolutely positively necessary. Now, if you want to get a hold of me, you can contact me at scotch@centurylink.net. That's scotch@centurylink.net. And don't forget, be sure to use all small letters on that. Don't use capitals, it won't go through. I'm also available to give this talk in person, and we can discuss that when you email me. I'll go anywhere in the United States if I have enough time. Thanks again for listening, and I hope to talk to you on our next program.